Buried is produced and distributed by KETR.org and is supported in part by its fans and listeners who visit KETR.org and click donate. Sponsorship opportunities for Buried are available from KETR.org/buried.
Nearly 4,500 unidentified bodies are found each year in the United States. This is according to NamUs, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. NamUs statistics show that in general, about 3,500 of those remains will eventually be identified. The rest might go to some form of cold storage in the best case scenario. It depends on the area. In some, the remains are buried in numbered graves, or, and this is the worst case scenario, cremated. In some underfunded areas, authorities literally incinerate any chance of recovering a loved one, unless they take DNA or fingerprints first. These days, police will usually try to do both, depending on the state of the remains. The samples are entered into national databases. When all else fails, there's a last resort, identification by sight. This is obviously the most traumatic method. Family members have to pore over photographs of people's remains, or reconstructions of what they might have looked like. Sometimes relatives will travel great distances to view the body of an unidentified person in the hopes it's their loved one, only to suffer disappointment after disappointment. Tens of thousands of families have been affected in this way. My family is one of them. Our story could be its own podcast, but I don't think I'll ever be satisfied with the few answers we have about my great-uncle John, who disappeared for decades from northeast Louisiana. At this point, I know more about Carrie Mae Parker than I ever did about him. But I didn't have to learn about Carrie to comprehend the hole that a disappearance leaves in a family. The trauma for those left behind is sticky, doesn't come off after a culturally agreed-upon period of mourning like when someone dies. The uncertainty keeps eating away at everyone. For those left behind, an unexplained disappearance can be a fate worse than the person's death. And yet, the trauma of losing a loved one under such circumstances is perplexingly hard to quantify. Sometimes I wonder if any of my more neurotic tendencies is linked to the fear and uncertainty that my grandmother suffered after losing track of her brother, passed down through my father before reaching me, maybe to any future children of mine, too, if I'm not careful. And don't just think because the person isn't around that you'll forget about them. Evidence of an absence is seemingly everywhere. You can find it without even looking. Like when Uncle John's brother died in a car accident on the Texas coast. He was stationed there in the Navy. The obituary in the newspaper back home listed the survivors and their locations. Among them, Donna Cooper, San Diego, California. Ross Cooper, Natchez, Mississippi. John Cooper, address unavailable. Everyone agrees Uncle John was smart. Very intelligent, with high IQ, my aunt texted me shortly before recording this. Which is partly why some of my more imaginative relatives speculate that he was in the CIA, or some other clandestine service. My suspicions aren't as thrilling. Then again, there are photos of him in a military uniform. We just can't find any record of him being in a military. Add that to some strange events that followed his disappearance. The strangest of all is undoubtedly the letters that arrived at my great-grandmother's house, for years. They were signed by a person calling himself Jim Saunders, stamped with out-of-state return addresses. During visits, my dad used to pester his grandmother with questions about the letters, how she knows this man, what all was he talking about. This is before he realized Saunders is actually Uncle John. At least, that is what many of my family believe, that he was writing letters under a pseudonym, for reasons that are unclear to this day. Saunders somehow knew about events that were going on in the lives of everyone in our family. In one of his letters, he wrote, "I have been closer than you think." If it really was him, I'm sure Uncle John meant to reassure his mother and family that he loved them and not to worry. But the phrase almost perfectly captures the living nightmare that tens of thousands of families will never stop experiencing. Is a loved one or their remains around the corner, waiting to be found? Maybe closer than they think? Like in the majority of missing person cases in the United States, Uncle John eventually turned up. He passed away in the 1990s. Not one person in my family is satisfied with the answers we got, but thank God some did come before his mother died. She spent years searching, calling people about bodies. Every time the newspaper reported that somebody was found dead anywhere within driving distance, she would try to find out if it was John. Her son-in-law, my grandfather, once traveled to Arkansas to see if a body that had been discovered there was her boy. It wasn't. All those stories and memories rushed back one day last July, when a different great-grandmother called my office, asking about a body.
Thank you.
From KETR Public Radio in Northeast Texas, I'm George Hale, and this is Buried, a podcast and investigative series about the disappearance of Carrie Mae Parker in 1991, and of Sarah Elizabeth Kinslow 10 years later. The woman who called my office looking for me is named Louise Kinslow. I met her and her husband about a week after a man named Mike Garris told me about a body in an area of Lake Tawakoni called Waco Bay. I didn't know it then, but the area is where Louise believes her daughter Sarah might be buried. So when she heard from Carrie Parker's sister Patricia what happened that day in Waco Bay, Louise called me to ask what I knew, just like my great-grandmother used to do. But before we get into that conversation, here's what Patricia and I talked about minutes after I left Waco Bay on the day that Mike tried to take me to see the body. I'm going to fast forward to the calmer moments of our conversation and get back to Mike and Ricky and all that in the next episode. I need to take a time out to explain Sarah Kinslow's ties to Waco Bay. This is all going to matter later.
I'm really actually very interested in going and seeing, because it could be one of two things. It could either be verifying the story Dad said, or it could possibly even be Carrie.
That would be insane.
That would be totally insane.
I mean, even if it's neither, it's a body in the woods that, like, should be known about.
Unlike Carrie's case, information about Sarah's has been covered in the national media. Her parents were even on the Montel Williams show, and the Huffington Post did a piece a few years back. So if you need to know the basics about Sarah, all you have to do is Google it. The very short version is that Sarah Kinslow was 14 on May 1st, 2001, when her father dropped her off at middle school in Greenville, Texas. She never returned. Her family believes she was seen at least three times since then, once at a gas station with an 18-year-old named Curtis Bell, who she considered her boyfriend despite her parents' objections. He is now in prison for sexually assaulting a different minor. Anyway, Sarah's parents believe she intended to skip school that day and meet up with her friends at a nearby cemetery. Curtis has family ties to both Hawk Cove and Waco Bay, and Sarah's parents believe it's likely that she is no longer alive and possibly buried at a property once owned by Curtis's family. What I want to talk about in this episode is stuff that isn't online, about Sarah's possible links to Waco Bay.
15, 16 years ago, they built a national park out there. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, there's a Texas sort of...
I was recording the moment Patricia realized this was the same place Louise had long suspected. Keep in mind that while we're months into this podcast, all of this is happening within 6 weeks of meeting Patricia and the rest of Carrie's family. On the day I met Mike, I didn't even know who Sarah Kinslow was. Plus, she disappeared from Greenville, the seat of Hunt County that's 25 miles north of Lake Tawakoni. I didn't know about rumors she had ties to Carrie's neighborhood. A year later, I'm certain she did.
Sarah Kinslow. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, but why? I don't know.
Well, she's missing too.
Oh, okay.
And her mom thought that Sarah might be over in that area where the lake is. So when you go and look up this place where you say you could find it on a map, You should be able to find that area where the lake is too, that runs up to the back of Waco Bay.
Okay.
And between the woods and all that other crap. It's not that far. I can go to it in my mind right now, because it's an area where back in the day when I was like 15, because I left home when I was a kid. I left home at 15. So I used to go with a bunch of people that smoked dope and all that kind of crap down there to this area before they turned it into the parks and recreation.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's why I know where it is.
Okay.
And I remember her telling me that she thought that they might have put Sarah in that bay down there. And they were supposed to do a search, but I don't know. So for all the hell I know, it could be her.
When did she go missing?
She went missing 10 years after Carrie did, 2001. Okay. So, I mean, even if it's not Carrie, it's somebody.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who it is. I mean, obviously, I prefer it to be Carrie for your sake, but, like, you know.
why did nobody report this dude or this dude or whoever it is missing?
I have no idea.
And who the hell comes across it? Did he say how he came across it or anything?
No, like I said, he talked about it like it was like a landmark. You know, I mean, he talked about it like, he didn't talk about, you know, he didn't say like, I remember the day, I remember the weather, you know, like when I saw the body, like it was, you know, it was like, oh yeah, there's a body, it's in the middle of the trail. You know, it's so obvious because the trail just goes over it, basically.
The trail goes over the skull?
Not the skull, but, you know, like the there's a bump in the trail and it's the body, you know, is the way he put it.
That's
what he was saying. It's not hidden. You know what I mean? It's like...
Wow. That's... Damn.
It would have been hard to text all that.
I couldn't trip any further if I was on LSD, dude.
I know. It's just ridiculous.
I hate lying. This is just crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And I wish I could say, it was like under like intense interrogation that he admitted there's a body, but no, he just brought it up.
But yet he didn't say anything to Haynes when Haynes went out there.
He didn't say Haynes even went there. Now, you know,
that could have been the Q Center, which is what I'm trying to... I did hear that they did take dogs. Remember when I told you they went and searched Pop's old place and stuff?
No, not really.
I didn't tell you that? Yeah.
Probably did, but I probably forgot.
Well, they came out and searched Dad's place, see? And that's what... It's like, so they believe the story that I tell them about what Dad said. They'll go and search that out, but yet they won't go and search out my sister. It just don't make no sense. None of this makes any freaking sense to me.
This might explain the confusion about whether or not the police ever visited Mike's property. Mike says no, but Patricia heard otherwise. The Q Center is a missing persons group that, among other things, helps in searches. After Patricia and I went to Waco Bay together and talked to Mike, I spoke to a representative of an organization that trains cadaver dogs, the ones that can find bodies in the ground. There are cases of dogs finding remains decades later, and in this area, we have so many reports of buried bodies that there's no telling what dogs might find. Carrie's father claimed to have killed and buried at least one man on Mike Garris's property, and Mike Garris claimed to know of a body 2 blocks south of that. A few blocks to the west of that is Curtis Bell's grandparents' old property, which is where Louise suspects Sarah might be buried. Anyway, so this group in the Dallas area agreed to search these sites if the Hunt County Sheriff's Office signed off, which at the time seemed like it wouldn't be an issue. The first two areas haven't been searched as of this recording, over a year later. Curtis's grandparents' old property was searched, but Sarah's mom thinks there's a spot that warrants further attention. Patricia called me to ask if I had a problem with her sharing this information with Sarah's mom. I didn't try to stop her, but you'll hear in a moment that I had reservations about tipping our hand with the police. I would later learn that it was a mistake to contact them so early, before I truly understood what I was getting into. It resulted in a disastrous confrontation at the Hunt County Sheriff's Office, when the detective in the case tried to pressure me into telling him where I got files from Carrie's case. But that's for another episode. We need to talk about Sarah first.
And Sarah was had a boyfriend who lived in the Waco Bay area, and that's who they think that she was with last.
Very interesting.
So, I guess my crossroads is, do I notify her or talk to her parents? I know her mom.
Oh, really?
Just because of the deal with, you know, that we share.
Uh-huh.
As far as she has a missing daughter, I have a missing sister. And
yeah.
Pretty much, you know, back down the Waco Bay area or the lake or whatever. I mean, I'm just curious whether or not I should discuss it with her. Maybe she can say stepmother and get dogs out there. So that's what I wanted to talk to you about, to see what you thought.
No offense to her daughter, obviously, but the focus of what we're doing is about Carrie. But, like, at some point, we're obviously going to want to talk about anyone else who's missing. And if possibly there's any connection, obviously, even if it's slim.
All right. Okay.
So, you know, it's probably a good idea to reach out to anyone. I'm sort of thinking to myself, I should be reaching out to different people who are missing people, too.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to get in touch with her first for on Facebook, because I know she'll accept my friendship and all, because she knows me. I even made her a hat.
That's nice. What's her thinking? What's her feelings on how they handled all this, her stuff?
I'm not sure now, because I do know that they've had several searches out.
Yeah.
to try to find her. And of course, she went through Greenville PD rather than Hunt County. And I know she hasn't had to deal with the stuff that I've had to deal with on Carrie's.
Yeah.
And the last known person she was with was in Waco Bay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think generally we should lean towards informing people of information, you know.
After this is done, and regardless of whether we find her or not, I'll be better off moving on because I do know that you have went far and beyond.
Yeah.
To try to find an answer, and nobody else has.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Obviously, yeah. It's good to hear that you feel good about the whole thing, you know, because it's quite a big ask, you know what I mean? To like,
yes,
this much time, this much attention, like, you know.
Yes. Y'all just don't know how important this is to me. Hello?
Hey.
Louise Kinslow and I played phone tag one day, about a week after Patricia and I returned to Waco Bay. Remember, I'm skipping ahead to talk about Sarah. I want you to know why Patricia thought it was so important to find out what was in Waco Bay. Anyway, Louise got down to business pretty quickly, while I struggled to keep up.
I've spoken to a man named Mike Garris.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and Trish, about a body out in Waco Bay?
Supposedly, yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah. Well, I tried to find that body, but I wasn't able to.
So, I'm Sarah Kinslow's mom.
Yeah.
And she's been missing since 2001.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear about that. It's nice to meet you, though.
And so I think she may be in Waco Bay or in the Suwanee State Park,
Perhaps. Okay.
I suspect, but I have no way of knowing, and the police have no way of knowing, and we've been looking for her. And, you know, you hear rumors and things like that. What was your take on this Mike Garris guy?
You know, I don't know what to think about a lot of this stuff, but I'll tell you, though, that, I'll also preface by saying I don't have a lot of crime reporting experience, and I'm not an expert on these things either. Kind of new to this, too. But to me, when he told me that there was a body in the forest and he could take it to me right now, like, I thought I was about to go to see a body in the forest. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's what it seemed like to me. Now, we didn't find it. So, you know, take that.
Right.
You know, so now I'm obviously rethinking it. But he didn't seem like a crazy man dreaming up some crazy stuff, you know?
Right.
It seemed he talked about it almost as if it was like well known.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't say that, but I got the impression, you know, that he was said something to the effect of, well, you know, there, because I don't know how much you know about this, why I was even talking to him, but I was asking him about rumors that there was a body on his property from before he lived there. So not that he had anything to do with. I wasn't accusing him of anything.
Right.
So, and he welcomed me onto the property to look. It's a very long story, and I'm happy to tell you if you're ever interested. It's totally unrelated to your daughter. This would have happened decades ago. And so when I was asking about it, he said, you know, it's interesting that you're asking about this because there is actually a body not far from here, and it's in the woods. It's just 2 minutes to driving, you know? So he seemed to be making a connection between my question and something he knew about. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I understand why you're interested in this, and I think I would be, too, if I were you.
Sure.
I wish I could tell you, get in the car, and I'll take you to it, but I couldn't find it. But maybe Mike, you know, and Mike, he went with me. He, you know, we looked around for it. It was getting dark, and, you know, it was just a weird situation in the first place, and he said it had been a very long time since he had seen it, and so his memory wasn't perfect, but I'll tell you, he seemed surprised, though, that he couldn't find it, which I found very interesting.
I've spent a considerable amount of time several years ago driving around in the Waco Bay area because I knew that the boy that Sarah was dating at the time, his grandparents lived out there on Baywood Drive.
Baywood, okay.
So, which is probably just a couple of blocks from... Trish told me it was on Elmwood Drive.
I really don't know the streets.
Right.
But whatever she said, I'm sure is right. She knows the area. And she went with me last week, too. She's the one who told me about Sarah and everything.
Right, right. We have something pretty in common.
Yeah.
So,
sorry about that, obviously, but you certainly have a good friend in her, because she sort of said it in a way that, like, you know, we really need to tell her, even if it lets the cat out of the bag of what we're doing. You know, you don't keep stuff like that from people. You know, so.
Right, right. Well, I have an appointment Tuesday morning with the detective who has Sarah's case.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah, and I've got a call into Mike, and he hasn't returned my call yet.
Okay.
And I wonder how he knew it was a body.
You know, the way he phrased it, I mean, he said, like, you know, he looked at me. I'm an average height male, you know, like 5'10", 160, you know, something like that. And he said, it was like you, you know. He was like, it's that long, that wide, sort of, you know.
Right.
And, yeah, so that's what, I don't know. I mean, I don't live in that world where you know about a body and don't tell anybody, so it's kind of hard for me to really understand, but...
Me too.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But, I mean, it's the Waco Bay area, so, you know, I mean, if he had no connection to anybody out there that was a body, then you would think that he would report it to the police, but I think Waco Bay area is a whole different world.
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I'm trying to sort of understand how some of the things I've heard could possibly be true. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And all I have is sort of people who either grew up there or still live there explaining it, and you don't get a very good explanation from them. You know, it's kind of like the way Mike Garris said it to me was like, you know, well, I knew that if I told the police about it, then it would be 5 hours of questions, you know, about something I had nothing to do with. So I don't know. I don't really have a response to that.
So, well, yeah, I would love to be able to get together and go out there and look at it. And Trish suggested that maybe we could get some dogs, some cadaver dogs. And
yeah, so
there.
A search dog unit or whatever in Mesquite basically volunteered their services for this property, the one that we're talking about, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. However, they need an invitation from the police. Or, you know,
of course they do.
Yeah.
I totally get that. And
yeah, yeah.
I have spoken to the detective, and I do have an appointment with him Tuesday morning, and I feel like that perhaps we could get him to invite them to come look.
Yeah,
he's been working on this a while, and he's not the first one. I'm sure he'd like to close it. So if you have the time Tuesday morning to go and talk to him with me.
Yeah.
That would be great. I would like to get Mike to, but I don't know. I mean, since he was in the first place extremely reluctant to tell anybody anything.
Yeah.
Apparently, he never told anybody anything other than maybe a close friend or something. Anyway, I have an appointment.
Yeah.
Tuesday morning at 9:30 at the police department.
Okay. I would certainly, you know, and I also certainly don't want to get in the way of what you guys are talking about in the first place. You know, that's not...
Yeah,
but,
well, I don't see that being an issue.
While I wasn't going to get in between a missing person's mother and the detective investigating the case, we had to address a few issues behind the scenes.
Hello?
Hey, Mark.
Hey.
Mark Haslett is the news director at KETR. He's an old-school newspaper reporter, exactly the person to answer this dicey ethical question. Is it ever okay to inform a government agency about what we're reporting on if we're keeping our listeners in the dark?
I think we might have to go talk to Jeff Haynes sooner rather than later.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is because the Greenville PD are about to find out everything on Tuesday morning, because this woman whose daughter is missing has caught wind of everything we're doing and, like, wants to talk to her detective about that area, the same area where the body supposedly was.
As a public media organization, we commit to reporting in the public interest. That means accountability for government institutions, such as a police department in our listening area.
Is there any reason why we would be not ready to talk to them? Is there anything that we would like to do before we talk to them?
I mean,
providing the police information while keeping it from the public is basically the opposite of what journalists working in public media are supposed to be doing.
I mean, my only concern is that, like, it'll be a while before this is done, and it might be kind of weird that we're, like, telling cops stuff before our listeners, but...
Yeah, I don't really like that either, but, you know, it's awfully hard to go nosing around with something like this and, you know, for people to not catch wind of it, you know, if it's...
Yeah.
We work for you, not the police. At the same time, you can't keep a body a secret, right? Plus, Luis made an appointment with the detective after learning about the supposed body from Patricia, not me. But I didn't object to her sharing that information, so maybe that's the same thing? These debates, of course, happen in newsrooms all day, every day. It's routine.
You know, if it's something that has been dormant for a long time, but that people know about and feel ways about, you know, I share your minor frustration. I would rather talk to them exactly when you feel like you're ready to. But at the same time, I actually kind of, the silver lining, I suppose, is at this point, I'm kind of welcoming anything that would just push us to the content production.
Mark and I went back and forth about that question before I finally called Haynes 3 days later on the way to meet Luis Kinslow in person.
You reached this sort of 15 to share something with professional standards. Please leave your name, number, date, and time you called, and reason for your call, and I'll get back to you just as soon as possible. Thank you.
When you have finished recording,
it turns out there wasn't any reason to worry. Haynes didn't answer for a year.
Hi, Sergeant Haynes. My name is George Hale. I'm a reporter for the NPR station in Hunt County. It's called KETR 88.9. I wanted to let you know that we're working on a sort of a radio series on a missing person here in Hunt County, and actually more than one. But I was wondering if you'd have time to speak with me really today, tomorrow, or Wednesday. I'm going to be in Greenville in just a few minutes. Pretty much the rest of the day, and then Tuesday I'll be free in the afternoon, and Wednesday in the morning. I don't know if you would be interested in hearing about some of the things that we've learned that might be new to you about the Carrie Parker situation, but either way, I really appreciate your time. My number is 214.
That left all morning to talk to Louise Kinslow at her house in Greenville. She was eager to tell me about Sarah's connections to the Quinlan area.
We went to look, driving around and passing out flyers for Sarah in the Quinlan area, because I just had this feeling, you know, that she would be out in that area probably with Curtis, and so.
She said it seemed like people throughout the area were hostile to her family's efforts to locate Sarah.
One of the places where we went to pass out a flyer. The clerk was really nice, and she's like, sure, put it right over there. And this customer in the store says, I don't know why you're bothering. I heard she doesn't want to be found anyway. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Who even hears stuff this is like a, that?
I said, yeah, who would say think something like that? I'm like, she's 15, and she's my daughter, and I'm supposed to keep her safe. It's my job, you know? And
so weird that someone would even know enough about it to comment, first of all, and then just...
And to say something stupid like that? But that's my impression of Quinlan. And when we would go put up flyers, and we would go to every restaurant, every convenience store, everywhere that we could, and put up flyers, and 2 days later, those flyers would be down.
Really?
Yes. Yes, 2 days later, those flyers would be down.
Everywhere or just that town?
In Quinlan, and really, we took them to Princeton, and I don't know where all we took flyers.
Yeah.
You know, but especially in Quinlan, the flyers would come down fast. You'd go back a week later, and the flyers would be gone.
Yeah. Is there any other place you've had a gut feeling about like that, or really is Quinlan the one?
It's Quinlan. Okay. That's where Curtis lived, was in the Hawk Cove area in Quinlan. And it's probably equally as bad as Waco Bay.
One thing I told Louise is that as an outsider, I really wasn't sure what to believe about this area. Are bodies really buried everywhere? It all seemed far-fetched, but not to her. After a year, I'm not sure anything about Lake Tawakoni could surprise me.
One of our older sons, Jerry, was in prison several years ago, back in the late 1990s. And he was still there when Sarah disappeared. And through his different people he knew there was a guy from the Quinlan area. I'm not sure which little lake lot place he was from, but he had told Jerry that Curtis and other guys would get together and drug girls, and several boys would have their way with the girls. And, you know, I mean, Sarah was supposed to be Curtis's girlfriend. I don't know why he would be that way with her. But that's what he told Jerry. Well, but then you're talking about the Quinlan area, and dispose of, I mean, I wonder if you went through there and you got rid of all the trees that were there, and you took a metal detector and cadaver dogs out there, what would you find? And if you emptied Lake Tawakoni, so, you know, it makes me wonder because of the area it is, and drugs are so prevalent out there. I mean, if you want something, you go to Quinlan. You go to Hawk Cove or Waco Bay or any of those areas. And Carrie had gotten tied up in that, and Sarah was starting to get tied up in that kind of stuff. So
that's interesting. I hadn't thought of your family's story being connected, but it really is in ways, you know.
Because of the area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Kind of is.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people disappear from that area. You know, bad drug deals gone bad or...
Yeah. Sarah Kinslow is officially missing from Greenville since May 1st, 2001. But her parents believe she's been seen at least three times since then. The first was by Sarah's younger brother about a week after she disappeared. He told police, but Sarah's parents say they didn't believe him. We spoke at length about Matt and a whole lot more in an extended interview that will follow this episode. The other two times people saw her were at a gas station, possibly with Curtis, and again on Christmas Day that year. Neighbors spotted her in a car.
Well, imagine that somebody saw Sarah in a car behind them. And they knew it was her. And soon as and she knew the people in the car in front of her. And they turned around and looked at her, and the car sped off in a different direction, even though they were in a designated turn lane. Would you think that was probably really her? If they recognized her,
especially
turned around, saw her.
Had known her since she was a baby growing up.
Since she was about, four or something, 4 or 5 years old.
This was a positive ID.
Yeah, okay. But it happened on Christmas Day in 2001. Well, I didn't find out for another day or two. These people didn't tell me about it.
Who's the guy?
It was a guy out of Princeton.
Yeah.
They had to track the car down. It was a what year model?
I don't know.
70-some-odd, brown over brown. Was it a Cutlass?
Could have been a Cutlass.
Or a Malibu? So I went out there. I bought a new pair of binoculars, a better pair than what we already had. I wanted to find my daughter, you know. Yeah. So I go out there on a very cold January day to Princeton. This guy's uncle, Massey, his last name was Massey, owned a wrecking yard in Princeton, quarter of a mile away. And I'm watching it with these binoculars, you know. Never saw anything. I think I saw the car in there when I drove past.
Mm-hmm.
Parked out in a different area and walked through a woodsy area. It was cold that day, too, I'm telling you. And, still using my binoculars, looking over that way, never saw anything, but I saw the car as I passed through. Mm-hmm. But it took them a while to find out who the car belonged to because it had changed hands several times just in the last couple of months before that.
Was the person someone that your daughter had a relationship with, or you? Or
no, never heard of him.
Gosh.
Never heard of him. And then there's these people in the restaurant in Quinlan said that they had seen her out there. I mean, not Quinlan, Princeton. Because mm-hmm. we had taken flyers out to Princeton once we heard about that. We flooded the town with flyers.
People said that they saw her?
Yeah, the people that were running this restaurant out there. A little L-shaped shopping center, and the restaurant was right here. But the thing is, if these people said they saw Sarah, they saw Sarah, and they saw her in that car.
Yeah.
And I made a terrible mistake when I was talking to the people at the restaurant, because the two guys, he was riding together in a pickup with this other guy. I think it was probably him. And so I followed them. And they came back into Greenville for something, or I lost them somewhere. Mm-hmm. But then I went back to the restaurant. I was talking to the people. Well, the guy in the pickup that was driving the pickup was their son. Oh, and so they just, they put up a wall, and it was over with.
Wow.
Yeah, they put up a wall. But I think Sarah had been with this Massey guy, hanging with him. And what was he doing in Quinlan, making a right-hand turn in Quinlan on the same place that could possibly lead him to Curtis's place? Yeah. It's a lot to take in, isn't it?
What month is she going to see him?
May.
Okay. So December, seeing her in December is crazy.
Okay. Yeah, that was a good thing. Seeing her in December is like, oh, she was still alive in December.
You don't think it's possible she's still alive now?
I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine her being alive and being where she wants to of her own free will and not contacting anybody in the family, because she had two sisters and a brother living here at the time.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys believe that Curtis hurt her? I mean, is that...
I think the possibility's there. I think he may have helped her OD by accident.
Yeah.
But he kind of preys on younger girls.
I noticed from his...
Yeah, because that other girl was 16, the reason he's in prison.
Yeah,
and he was 24 at the time. So that's when he got in trouble with this other girl. And now the thing about that is, and you probably already know, that she ran away for a couple of weeks. This other girl, she ran away for a couple of weeks, and guess where he took her? To his grandparents' house.
Waco Bay.
Oh,
right, Waco Bay. That's like a block away from where the body supposedly would be, right?
Yes. Elmwood, that was like two blocks away, I think.
Where did you want to look for Sarah, though?
In the woods and Tewakoni State Park.
Why is there?
Because that's so close to Waco Bay. It's right next door to it. And there was a place on Curtis's grandparents' property that from satellite view a few years ago, you could see a rectangular lump in the ground towards the back of the property. And I'm like, I could put a body in that.
Yeah. Did you ever contact his grandparents?
No, his grandparents have passed, I think. Uh-huh. But in the trailer house that was there, and the fence is gone, the sheet metal fence. The trailer house is gone. Curtis's parents have it at their place now. They have moved their stuff into that trailer house because it was bigger than the one that they had.
So there's a different person who owns the property?
Well, The Q Center for Missing People mm-hmm. went on that piece of property after getting permission and searched with their dogs. The only thing is, they had to get the permission from the new owners. And after a while, it struck me that the new owners were probably Curtis's parents.
Oh.
I don't know, but that's what I suspect. I highly suspect that.
We can find out easily, I think.
But now they say it belongs to somebody else named Joe. So I don't know, but...
But they checked.
Yeah, they did. They looked, but there's another thing. The area that I was interested in was piled up with all kinds of tree limbs and leaves and all kinds of debris, and not just in an area that was this wide and 6 feet long. Mm-hmm. It was in an area that was 15 by 15, and that whole, so you couldn't get close. Mm-hmm. You couldn't really get real close into that. That seems to me to be suspicious, but I rather believe that Curtis was involved in her disappearance because she was with him. That is a verified fact, and that's not my opinion. That is a fact because she was seen on the video.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, with him.
And he didn't even deny that it was him the first, right?
Oh, no. The first time, so you saw what that said.
I saw that, yeah.
He said it was him. Yeah, he said it was him, but that was Michelle. That wasn't Sarah, that was Michelle. Well, I'm sorry, but I do recognize Sarah. And I recognize the way she walks because she would take long strides and she'd swing her arms really big when she walked. It's something you know about your child, you recognize immediately in the video, though the video was very, very poor quality. And it was her. So I asked him about that, and he said it was Michelle. And I asked him about 2 months later, and he said that wasn't him. Well, which was it? Was it you or not?
Yeah.
You said it was.
Is it obvious from the camera or from the video that it's him, or do you just know that because he told you?
The police officer that showed me the video, he said, I think that's Curtis. Do you think that's Curtis? And I said, you know, I can't be 100%. But on Sarah, I'm 100%.
Yeah.
I knew it was her because of the way she walked. She had cut her hair short.
Recently, before she went missing, or after?
After she went missing, she cut her hair short and dyed it brown. Which, if I was a 14-year-old girl and I was going to run away from home, you know what I'd change first? I'd change my hair.
Yeah.
I would change my hair.
Do you think she wanted to run away from home?
I think it was her plan. I think she planned it.
Why is that? Just teenage angst?
Teenage, yeah. Just rebellious. Mm-hmm. You know, she'd gotten to where she wasn't coming home and being at home when she was supposed to, and I wanted her home before dark every night because it's the parents' job to protect the children. Okay. You know, and so I wanted her home before dark, and sometimes she'd come in right after dark, the last, about 2 weeks before she ran away, she and I really had it out over that. And she ran into her room, and I don't think until I get Alzheimer's, I'll never forget. She ran into her room and started jamming her backpack with clothes, and she's leaving. I'm like, no, you're not. She said, you wait. She said, I will leave. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up because I knew she meant it. I knew she meant it, and then she did.
Buried is produced by Emma Anderson and me. Its executive producer is Jared Knight. Brad Davis composed the original theme music, and podcast cover art is by Crystal Sid. Our photographer is Brittany Greider. Her photos of many of the locations featured in this podcast can be found at instagram.com/buried.radio. Buried is also on Facebook and Twitter, and our email address is buried@ketr.org. Go to ketr.org/buried for an always up-to-date list of episodes and more. Special thanks to Laura Kinnemer, Christy Roundtree, Jeffrey L. Moore, and Rhonda McKeehan. Thanks also to the Public Information Officer at the Rockwall County Sheriff's Office. And thanks again to Daniel W. Ray, Susan Jin, and Claudia Alvarado. Buried is a production of 88.9 KETR, public radio for Northeast Texas. To support Buried, go to ketr.org and click the red donate button. And thanks.